Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 20 years ago, cyclists and activists in San Francisco got together to form the first critical mass bike ride. The goal was to increase the visibility of bicyclists and reclaim public space. The ride became a regular once-a-month institution and spread from San Francisco to other cities around the country and globe. Critical Mass celebrated its 20th birthday in San Francisco on September 29th. Thousands of cyclists, including first-timers, parents, and children, took part in the 3.5-hour ride. The San Francisco Mass Transit Authority is seeing about 75,000 bike trips per day. And San Francisco is not alone. A U.S. Census Bureau survey shows a 66% increase in bicycle commuters from 2002 to 2010. So what explains this? Are you biking more? What are you seeing in your city? And how is the increase in biking changing your city? What steps is your city taking to attract more bikers? Today we're joined by Peter Brown. He's manager of the San Francisco Mass Transit Authority's Climate Action Strategy and Bicycle Counting and Reporting Programs. Peter is also a faculty member in the Environmental Science Program at the University of San Francisco, and he joins us here in studio. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose.
It's great to see you. Peter and I just realized we went to high school together, and we haven't seen each other since, so it's great to see you. And I'm also joined by Chris Carlson. He's a writer, San Francisco historian, and avid bicyclist. He helped co-found Critical Mass in September 1992 and has ridden with Critical Mass rides in a dozen cities on three continents. Chris conducts award-winning bicycle and walking history tours, highly recommended, and his latest book is called Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20. And Chris also joins us in studio. Hi, Chris. Thanks for biking in.
Thanks, Rose. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. And we're also joined by Fritz Bredahl. He's head of communications at the Danish Cyclists Federation, a non-governmental advocacy group that's part of the umbrella organization, the European Cyclists Federation. It started more than 100 years ago in Copenhagen. Fritz is an avid cyclist and a former TV journalist at the Danish Broadcasting Corporation. And Fritz joins us from Copenhagen. Hi, Fritz. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be with you.
Hi, it's great to have you. So why don't we start off by talking about what explains this massive increase in cycling? I mean, you've got articles about the increase in bicycling in The Economist and Forbes magazine, really also talking about the economy behind bicycling. There's a new study that finds when people bike, they actually spend more because they spend more time at local businesses. So, Chris, what explains this massive growth?
Well, I think people have a desire for a better life, and life is better when you get out of your car and out of the ball and chain of debt dependency that cars represent. Not that everybody who bicycles gives up having a car, but many of us have made that decision, and we found our lives quite liberated in that choice. And then you're out in the streets. You're smelling the city differently. You're actually rolling through the open atmosphere. You're seeing your friends. When you see somebody you know, you don't have to go hunt for parking and hope they're still there when you get back. You just pull right over and talk to them. Your life immediately has been improved. Now there's the whole mental health aspect of going to work and coming home from work as a commuter. You know, you're going in, you're not stuck in a car listening to propaganda pouring at you, buy this, buy that, hurry, rush, get here, 10 minutes, here's the traffic, run, hurry. No, you have this calm experience. I mean, it's, you know, traffic mayhem sometimes, but mostly you can be in your own mental space on a bicycle in a way that's much more difficult to do, I think, in a car. And then you have, you know, the experience of getting off of work and you're stressed or you're, you know, have your day, your grind that you've been through, whatever it might be to you. And now you can change gears in a very literal sense and just roll through the streets and smell the air and feel the fog or the sun, as the case may be, and hear the birds. It's a really big boost for the general welfare and health of the individual and the culture that individual lives in.
And Peter, what would you add to that? It's amazing when you look at the San Francisco Mass Transit Authority's latest numbers that 75,000 bike trips are taken per day in the city.
Yeah, I think Chris did a good job of covering some of the big points. I might add that urban planning policy, as a trained urban planner, you know, how cities supply and provide and price parking has a big influence. Those of us that live or work in San Francisco know that parking is a challenge, and a lot of folks are finding In fact, some of the folks that work here in the studio that riding your bike a couple of miles to work is a pretty easy and fun thing to do. There's also been a lot more awareness about the health benefits. And a lot of folks are saying, you know what, if I ride my bike once or twice a week, you know, I'm meeting a great cardiovascular workout for myself, and my doctor's happy, and my cholesterol is lower, and I'm happier. So, yeah.
And Chris, you've been doing Critical Mass for 2 decades now, and I rode on September 29th and
28th, actually.
28th, sorry about that. Thank you. And saw a lot of parents with children and a lot of first-timers. Mm-hmm. What are you hearing from people? I mean, what changes have you seen over the decades?
Well, I mean, one of the early changes that we noticed a few years into Critical Mass, actually just within a year or two, is suddenly there was the occasional experience of a motorist looking over their right shoulder before turning right, to see if there was a bike coming up behind them on the right. That never happened before Critical Mass started, never. And suddenly motorists were becoming aware that we were out on the streets and that they needed to pay attention. So that was an early experience that we saw. You know, from then on, it's just a matter of more and more people on bikes. I remember in the early 90s, my daughter was very young at the time, and we used to drive to school, you know, as most parents think they have to drive their kids in a car to school, although I have many friends now who take their kids on bikes. And in those days, we would count the bikes because there were so few, just crossing from the east side of the Mission over to the Castro where she went to school, and we would count them and be so excited if we got to 10 bikes across the neighborhood. Now, you couldn't go one block and not count twice that many bikes most days, you know, or maybe not 20 in one block, but, you know, in just a couple of blocks, you'd see a lot more bikes. So the steady increase of daily cycling that started back in the early 90s has been a profound impact of Critical Mass and the... Not just Critical Mass by any means. You know, there's a larger bike culture out there. I sometimes refer to aspects of it as an outlaw bike culture, as I called it in my book Nowtopia. But I also think that there's the mainstream bike culture as well. The Bike Coalition, obviously, the major representative of that in town, and all of these things working together, sort of a broad ecology of advocacy and activism, have produced an opening and a kind of invitational culture that has invited people to try something different and make it pretty easy to get your first pedal in. Now we can say your first step is your first pedal.
And Fritz, you are in Copenhagen, and I remember riding in Critical Mass, and a lot of people, a lot of tourists especially, stop and take photos. And I remember hearing a guy from Denmark say, "Hey, what's the big deal? We see this all the time where we're from." So what is it like in Copenhagen? Are you seeing numbers increase there? And can you just paint us a picture of what it's like to bike there?
Yeah, numbers have increased in Copenhagen over the past few years. It's more in Copenhagen and the other bigger cities in Denmark than out in the countryside, where actually there's been a decrease. But I think one of the big turning points in Denmark was a few years ago when we hosted the COP15, the environmental conference summit there. The conference itself was a pretty big failure, but the fact that practically all the international media came to Copenhagen and reported on the very spectacular Danish and Copenhagen bicycle style, where you see tons of people on bikes. You see people on bikes everywhere in Copenhagen throughout the year, even if it's raining or snowing. You have 36% of everyone working in Copenhagen who bikes to work. So any time of the year, you see tons of people. And the fact that the international media reported on this was kind of an eye-opener for not least Danish politicians who, like everyone else in Denmark, just take it for granted and don't see anything special about it. But when you have New York Times and CNN and everyone else reporting on Danish bicycle culture, you realize that it's unusual.
And I understand that you have various campaigns. Everybody Bikes to Work, for example, All Children Bike, yep, and Big Bike Day, which is a specific day where you invite people around the country to get on your bike on their bikes. So we're talking about a country of about 5.5 million, and every year more than 300,000 participate in these campaigns?
Yeah, that's right. We have the Bike to Work campaign, where it's not so much about competition. It's about you go with your colleagues on your bikes to work, and you have fun, and you report how many days you bike to work. And the competition there is a matter of how many days you bike to work, not how fast you go to work, or how many kilometers. And I guess that symbolizes the Danish bicycle culture, where it's different from many other countries in that it's not about sports, where in many countries you put on your kind of sports gear and sports clothes, or you kind of make a statement when you bike. There might be some political statement in it that you're concerned about the environment. The reason people bike in Denmark is simply that it's nice and easy. It's convenient. That's the overwhelming reason. And we want to maintain that culture where it's nice and easy and it's good fun. It's not about being very competitive or it's about being healthy, but it's not about being fanatically healthy. That's what's the most unique thing about the Danish bicycle culture is that it's so everyday and so normal.
Chris?
Well, I loved hearing from Fritz about Copenhagen. My mother's from there, and my grandmother was riding her bike up until age 88 in Klampenborg, the northern suburb of Copenhagen. And it's very common there to see people of great age disparities from 8 to 88 riding around. But I think one of the key elements of the success of the Danish bicycle culture is the fact that they provided the infrastructure in a way that most places in the world have not. So maybe, Fritz, you could explain to listeners here what the actual experience is. I mean, my life and brief lives in Copenhagen, never more than a few weeks at a time. You know, wherever you go, most boulevards have their own dedicated space for bicycles. And it's the sidewalk, yeah. Then there's a curb, and then a bike path, and then a curb, and then there's motorized traffic and parking, mm-hmm. and sometimes no parking. And that really makes it easy for people to choose to cycle when you have your own space that's your right of way.
Yeah, absolutely. When I say it's nice and easy, you're absolutely right. That's because we have the infrastructure. We have the Copenhagen bicycle lanes. Often we asked when we go abroad, what's the secret behind the Danish bicycle culture? And there's no secret. It's pretty simple. It's exactly what you say. You build some bicycle lanes. You built the infrastructure, and the cost of bicycle lanes is absolutely nothing. It's peanuts compared to car infrastructure. Like at the moment, there's a project to have a new network of 300 kilometers of new bicycle lanes from the suburb into the suburbs into the city center of Copenhagen, and the cost of all that is about the cost of 1 or 2 kilometers of a car highway. You're talking about very little money, but that little money has been invested in Copenhagen, particularly after the oil crisis in the 70s. They invested that money, and they've built on that platform. So now it's just an everyday part of Copenhagen life.
And Peter, what about here in San Francisco? What steps is the city taking to add more bike lanes? I mean, I'm seeing a lot more just, you know, riding around, walking around on a regular basis.
Thanks, Rose. I think the city of San Francisco is on the front edge of, say, where Copenhagen was maybe 20, 30 years ago. We're really beginning to push for the newer infrastructure, the separated bike lanes. We're looking to put in more bike boulevards, which is a concept that you might see in Berkeley or some other cities that basically provide space on a calmed residential street for cyclists.
And what are bike boulevards exactly?
A bike boulevard is just a roadway that cyclists can go through without a lot of stopping at stop signs or stoplights, and you use traffic control planter boxes, and a lot of the cross streets typically have stop signs. So that's a way to traffic calm, which is another reason why cyclists come out more when the roads, the speed of traffic is slower. So as I was saying, that we're beginning to get where Copenhagen was a while back. We're also looking for new regional, state, and federal sources because a lot of money, as Fritz pointed out, the amount of money it costs to build a roadway system and maintain it is incredibly more expensive than building bike infrastructure. So working with our sources of funding, we're lobbying to get greater allocations to build the kind of infrastructure we would like. San Francisco has adopted some goals to try and get to 20% of trips by 2020. Right now we're in that 3-4% range. Copenhagen's in that 30-35% range. Mm-hmm. So we have a long way to go. But the good news is when I looked back and I said, okay, what did Copenhagen do 30 years ago? One of the things they did was education and outreach. They went into the schools, they talked to the children, they talked to the parents, they had a big program to When you and I were in high school, Rose, we had a driver education class, and we were so excited to get our driver's license.
And my driver education teacher was drunk half the time when he came to class. Sorry, you just brought up a memory.
Yeah, let's leave that out. But
anyway.
So in other words, as a way to get in and change the culture, because it's a part of the culture in the Netherlands and in Germany and in Denmark. So to make it be a part of our culture and to have it be, you know, something that's normal and not an alternative form of transportation.
Right. So this is interesting. So do San Francisco officials look to cities like Copenhagen for some guidance on how they got to where they are today? And what other places do you look to?
Absolutely. I mean, we had a group of folks from the Netherlands come last year and conduct what we called a Think Bike workshop, where they came and they rode our streets with us and said, okay, how would we do this in the Netherlands? You know, what would we do differently? You know, we've talked to, in developing our infrastructure plans, we've talked to cities all over the world that are doing a really good job. And so there's a lot of sharing of information and of strategy on how to get these things done. And we're considered a leader, along with a few other cities in the U.S. New York has done a lot lately. Minneapolis, Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles is coming to the fore now. So yeah, it's almost like a really positive competition to see which city can do the most for cyclists.
That is Peter Brown, manager of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Authority's Climate Action Strategy and Bicycle Counting and Reporting Programs. Chris Carlson is a writer, historian, avid bicyclist. He helped co-found Critical Mass in September 1992. He's ridden in a dozen cities on three continents. His latest book is Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20. And we're joined by Fritz Bredahl. He is head of communications at the Danish Cyclists Federation, a non-governmental advocacy group, which is part of the umbrella organization, the European Cyclists Federation. And today we are talking about biking and the increase in biking. Are you biking more? What is it like in your city? Are you seeing more bikers? In about 10 minutes, we'll be joined by someone with People Power in Santa Cruz, where the Santa Cruz Regional Transportation Commission recently bought 32 miles of corridor from the Union Pacific Railroad, and that will be converted into a trail for biking and walking. So what changes are you seeing in your city? How is the increase in biking changing your area? And what steps is your city taking to attract more bikers? What would you like to see? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you've been to other cities, what is it like there? And what can we learn from other places around the globe? Let's hear from Alan in San Francisco. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I've been bicycle commuting, and I'm actually not a frequent commuter these days. Maybe it's just old age creeping in, but I commuted back in the 80s, and I worked for a number of medium-sized firms that provided both secure lockups for their employee bicycle commuters, as well as showers and lockers, so that when you arrived at work, you could clean yourself up and change your clothes, and I find that that's missing in today's environment.
Do you think that would get more people to bike?
I definitely do.
Thank you. I've heard of this. Some companies doing this. Chris?
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear about it happening in the 80s. I was alive during that time and cycling all over, and I hardly ever heard of anybody having those kind of amenities, and they still basically don't exist in very many places. There are some companies that have added that in now, where, you know, typically high-tech companies with the money that they're rolling around on can
right.
put in a shower or two and a couple of bike parking facilities, but it's in no way a systematic effort to alter the infrastructure of, you know, employment sites or the city in general. And that, of course, brings up larger questions of all sorts of things, from plumbing to energy use and everything else, which you can only talk, I mean, you start pulling on the thread of transportation, you kind of need to pull on all those other threads too. We really need to talk about a more systemic transformation of urban life.
Well, are you seeing employers change anything because of or try to advocate biking, maybe add some incentives for employers or employees who bike? Peter?
We're seeing that a lot in San Francisco. We have a transportation demand management program, which basically is a term that says instead of increasing the supply of automobile lanes or even transit facilities, let's see how we can influence people's behavior. And so the city has recently passed a new ordinance that requires employers to either provide safe parking for cyclists or to allow them to bring their bikes inside the buildings where they work. That's an example of something that cities can do. For new buildings, we're reviewing new development in a way that we didn't do before, looking to add these facilities for parking and showering and those type of things. So it's definitely something. I would say bike parking, especially when you look to Europe, they have so much demand that secure bike parking is very important. And now they're telling us we didn't supply enough. So you guys are at the beginning. Make sure you get the bike parking right.
Speaking of bike parking, my friend works at Warm Planet, where they park bikes at Caltrain station, and they're already overflowing. And that's like the newest facility built here to accommodate approximately 200 bikes a day, or a little less than that, actually. And they find that every day there's 5 extra bikes from the day before. Just over the last 2 weeks, they've been having this huge influx. And so it looks like we're already, bursting at the seams with what little bit of infrastructure we've created so far. So big work ahead.
Yeah, and Fritz, what does it look like in Copenhagen? What are employers doing to accommodate bikers?
It's not perfect, but they're doing a lot more than you used to in the States. It's quite normal that employers provide facilities where you can shower when you get to work, and of course parking is so basic that you will find fairly good parking at practically at most workplaces. And also, it's like I said, 36% of everyone working in Copenhagen bikes to work. The ambition is to raise that to 50% within the next few years. And everyone bikes, including some of the CEOs. I remember talking to one of the CEOs of one of the bigger companies in Denmark, Novozymes, and he said the only time he took the car to work was on Sunday, where he would bring in 6 pieces of identical black suits and put it in his office, and the rest of the week he biked to work and just put on one of those suits, a new one, every morning. But he would bike into work and take a shower and put on the suit. And it's perfectly normal for CEOs of big companies and for many of our politicians at Parliament, including ministers, bike around. We high-ranking ministers, foreign ministers. This will surprise some of the ministers coming from other countries that you have, like a Secretary of State, the Foreign Minister, biking around the city. But it's very normal.
Let's take one more call before we go to break. Let's hear from Mark in Oakland. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. As I said, I was saying to Rose, I drive a truck in the city every day, a delivery vehicle, and I'm all over the city. It's sort of adversarial with the bicyclists. And to be honest with you, I'm not really comfortable sharing the same road with the bicyclists. And I respect the fact that they want to ride, and I admire them for that, but it's just so dangerous. It's tough enough with the cars and the trucks in the city. I don't know what the solution is.
And Mark, let me ask you, why aren't you comfortable sharing the road?
Well, it's really tough. The bicyclists, they're all the way over in the right, to the very right, between the parked cars and the lane. And if you're trying to make a right turn, there have been a couple of times I almost hit a cyclist. You're trying to make a right turn, and you just don't see this guy flying down, DuBose, at the last minute. You see him, and you stop, but and I just had to fight my way down Valencia, not really fight my way, but come down Valencia. And different cyclists are going different speeds, and it's just very uncomfortable.
Well, Mark, we've got to take a quick break, but I'd love for you, if you have a couple minutes, to be in dialogue with Chris, who's an avid cyclist, because it's an important conversation to have. So if you can stay on the line, that would be great. Today we are talking about biking. Are you biking more? What's it like in your city? What are your thoughts on Mark's call? And how is your city changing to advocate for biking? We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco, a program that depends on engaged listeners. We're inviting you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. And that's where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter as well. Just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page at yourcallradio.org. yourcallradio.org, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and coming up tomorrow, it's our weekly media roundtable. We will have a conversation about media coverage of the issues raised during the second presidential debate, including energy policies and Libya. What is your assessment of the coverage? What issues have yet to be discussed? We'll be joined by Harper's Scott Horton, The Guardian's Jonathan Steele, and Mother Jones' Kate Shepard. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the increase in bicycling in Northern California, around the country, and really around the world. A U.S. Census Bureau survey shows a 66% increase in bicycle commuters from 2002 to 2010. And on September 28th, Critical Mass celebrated its 20th birthday in San Francisco. Thousands of cyclists took part in the 3.5-hour ride. And we have full lines right now. We'll have one open in just a couple minutes. Are you biking more? What is it like in your city? Are you seeing more bikers? How is the increase in biking changing your city? What steps is your city taking to attract more bikers? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website so others can see it. Today we're joined by Peter Brown, manager of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Authority's Climate Action Strategy and Bicycle Counting and Reporting Program. He bikes into work every day from Marin County. Chris Carlson is a writer, historian, avid cyclist. He helped co-found Critical Mass in September 92. He's ridden in a dozen cities on three continents. He conducts award-winning bicycle and walking history tours. His latest book is Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20. And we're also joined by Fritz Bredahl. He is head of communications at the Danish Cyclists Federation. He is joining us from Copenhagen, where, of course, taking a shower when you get to work is just normal. This is how they do it in Copenhagen. And so, Mark, are you still on the line?
I'm still here.
Okay, good. So I wanted you to get in dialogue with Chris. And Chris, Mark calls us regularly. He drives a truck in San Francisco and says he's really uncomfortable sharing the road with cyclists.
Well, I think that's mutual. You know, bicyclists are really uncomfortable sharing the road with the excessive amount of automobile and truck traffic that's in San Francisco. And all of us would prefer to have a reduced traffic load. I'm sure as a motorist, or especially as a truck driver, you have a very, you know, particular vision of what you're there to do. You're going to make deliveries or pickups, as the case may be, and you'd rather there was nothing impeding you. Just like the person who goes out and buys a new car wishes the road was just as empty as it was in all those car ads they were watching, and they were the only people in the whole country using the roads. We all would prefer that. That's the fantasy we all have, and it's sold to us day in and day out, that we should have total personal autonomy and nothing ever impedes our freedom to go wherever we want whenever we feel like it. The fact is the infrastructure, as it's presently constituted, does not facilitate that. It actually pits us against each other, and we end up being in these very difficult and awkward moments, which are actually extremely dangerous for cyclists at certain moments, and relatively dangerous for the motorists as well, who are, and I appreciate Mark's caution and looking over his shoulder and screeching on the brakes when somebody's peeling down on the right side, which might be me on a given moment. So it's not easy. There's no perfect solution under the way things are currently constituted. So, you know, Peter's advocacy earlier in the conversation for bike boulevards was really heartening to me, because this is what I've been hoping for a very long time. I advocated as early as the late 80s. I put out a small little pamphlet. Didn't get very far, but it was called Calling for a City of Panhandles, which is to think about having dedicated green bikeways crisscrossing the city, say three or four of them going north-south, three or four going east-west, and two or three diagonals. And if you could have that, where there's room for people to cycle comfortably through the city without ever having to enter normal streets, hardly at all, except to cross them occasionally, and people to walk calmly through the city and not be in a hurry and being run over by either cyclist or motorized traffic, which is actually a far greater danger to pedestrians, and space not just for humans, but for other critters to move through the urban environment as well, which we tend to completely neglect in these conversations, that we're not here alone. And we live on a natural space, a natural system. which we basically have built an infrastructure that contradicts it and fights against it. And what we really need to do is re-engineer city life to be in harmony with natural systems. And part of that would be a small step in the right direction would be bike boulevards first, and then later more comprehensive greenways.
And Mark, what's your response? And what do you think, what needs to change so you do feel comfortable on the road with cyclists?
Well, I think some education would help on both sides. I wish people would probably leave maybe 5 minutes earlier so people aren't in such a hurry to get places. They could take a little more time, be a little more attentive. I love the idea of the bike boulevards. I'm thinking of what streets we could currently close in the city. And there's not really any streets that aren't currently full use all the time. And even if we divided a street part cycles, part cars, I don't know if that would be a solution. I mean, with an actual border, a median that cars couldn't cross. I like what the people are saying. We need to do something. But thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's so important to have this dialogue. And Peter, as someone who works for the city, clearly, I mean, as Chris said, the infrastructure pits us against each other. Mark says he's not comfortable, but he'd like to work together to have a dialogue. What are your thoughts? And what role does the city play when we have this conversation?
Well, we've touched on a few of the points that I think are really important for safety of all users of the system, whether you're delivering in a truck or you're riding your bicycle. One of the things I like to ask folks to do that are driving, and if we have a captive audience on the radio now, everyone who drives a car, rides a bike, look around and slow down and make eye contact. I always look for eye contact when I come to an intersection, make sure the driver sees me, nod of the head. The drivers that pay a lot of attention, I can tell right away, and we're more comfortable in that system. Our job in the city is to do primarily infrastructure work, but also the education, the outreach, working with our partners at the Transportation Authority and at the Bike Coalition. And with rides like Critical Mass that really hope to get the message out there. So that's our role. In better planning and design, I think when we design roadways to facilitate fast movements of cars, we shouldn't be surprised if, we have conflict and folks aren't comfortable using those roadways. Complete Streets is a new movement nationwide, and it's something that the city of San Francisco is a big advocate of. And that has to do with redesigning our streets for all users of the transit system, automobiles, pedestrians, and bicyclists as well.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Mark. Let's hear next from Betsy in San Francisco. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, I was just calling in. I actually started riding my bike in Manhattan, and the only thing that got me to ride was Critical Mass because it felt so scary out there on the street. And I totally agree that education and outreach is the number one thing, because when you listen to the last caller, Mark, it's nerve-wracking to like be out there and like have to share the space on the road with a giant truck, and like people tend to sort of go to the side, to the right, but really they're just putting themselves in danger. And I think motorists need to know like how to handle themselves around bikes and to understand that they need to take that space. And I guess the other thing that I would love to see, which I just thought of, was I hate when cars double park in the bike lane. It's like throwing you into the intersection and the roadway, and it's really dangerous, and it happens all the time. And I feel like I know in New York they don't do anything about it, and I don't see San Francisco doing anything either.
Well, thank you. And on that point, we actually have an email from Don who says, I've been bicycling in San Francisco for 20 years. My biggest gripe is that despite constant urging, the MTA refuses to ticket illegally double parked cars that can be found lining the whole length of the bike lane on Valencia Street. Why is this? Peter?
Well, let me just first say, I don't think we refuse to ticket anyone. If,
no,
if you,
you
talk
don't.
To folks in San Francisco, that you'll get an earful on how many tickets we write, and it's something we're looking to address in a more comprehensive way. We do write tickets for folks double parking, but I completely agree. If someone uses the bike lane, to have to go out into the auto lane because someone's double parked, that's an enforcement issue, that's a budget issue, and it's something we're definitely dedicated towards improving. In terms of the sharing the lanes, people have talked several times, it's come up about cyclists being fully to the right side of the road. Actually, to give credit to Mike Salaberry, who works in our Livable Streets subdivision, and they do a lot of our engineering and implementation. It's a great group of folks at MTA. bike sharrows, shared lanes, is where cyclists and drivers who mostly travel at the same speed have the same right to the center of the lane. And we've done a lot of sharrows. It's the thing that you'll see a symbol of a cyclist with a chevron, like a double arrow over the top of it, and you'll see those all over San Francisco. And that's a signal to drivers and to bicyclists that, hey, look out for both of you in this lane. And those seem to be working pretty well. There's a learning curve to get out there, but it's coming along. But I agree with the caller. I mean, enforcement's a big issue. You know, we've recently increased the enforcement on our transit system in terms of folks using Muni, which MTA operates as well, and that's had good returns for us. So there's only so much policing we could do, but I can't disagree that it needs to be done.
And Fritz, how do you deal with these issues in Copenhagen? Do you hear from drivers complaining about bikers and talking about, you know, feeling uncomfortable sharing the road?
They don't put it that way, feeling uncomfortable sharing the road, because they are used to it. But yeah, we do have a certain amount of conflict. And the kind of accusation from car drivers is that the cyclists think they own the city. A lot of cyclists in Copenhagen, and therefore car drivers know this, and they look out for the cyclists. Sometimes they think the cyclists don't behave well, and they to a certain extent have a point, that the number of cyclists in Copenhagen is so massive that some cyclists tend to not obey the rules, which is not good for the traffic culture, of course. But the thing is that the more cyclists you have in a city, you can show this statistically, the more cyclists you have, the safer it becomes. So in order to increase safety, you need to increase the number of cyclists, because when everyone knows that you have to watch out for each other, it becomes and have eye contact, the things that you mentioned, safety increases. So it's safe. It's one of the safest cities to bike in, Copenhagen. But we do have some conflict. I think it's unavoidable. But of course, you have to. The problem is if it's not safe. One thing is a conflict, smaller conflict. But if the conflict results in fatalities and in serious accidents, that's bad, of course. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of those.
That is Fritz Bredahl. He is with the Danish Cyclists Federation. Chris Carlson is author of Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20. And Peter Brown is with the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Authority's Climate Action Strategy. And I'd like to welcome our next guest from Santa Cruz. Amelia Conlin is Director of People Power in Santa Cruz. And the Santa Cruz Regional Transportation Commission just bought 32 miles of corridor from the Union Pacific Railroad, which will be converted into a trail for biking and walking. Hi, Amelia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is exciting news. How did this happen?
This is the culmination of many, many years of work, more than a decade of work by People Power and the Regional Transportation Commission and the organization, the Friends of the Rail and Trail. And there have been folks agitating for a purchase of the rail line and for the construction of a trail along the rail line for many years. It involved a lot of political battles. We ended up getting state money allocated through Prop 116 for the construction of a trail. And after many stalls and snags, the purchase was just signed about a week ago.
And so what is the time frame from here? When do you think this will be finished?
Well, there are two components to this project. So part of it is going to involve maintaining the existing rail line and actually having train service along the rail line. We're starting with some tourist trains that will be going between Santa Cruz and Davenport. And we have a rail line operator in place to manage that. And then the second aspect of the project is the multi-use trail. And we have $7 million allocated towards building that, but that's just a fraction of the total cost. We are in the planning process, and the Regional Transportation Commission will be releasing the draft plan later this month. So once that's finalized, then it will involve figuring out which sections to work on first and figuring out how to pay for it.
And you say agitating. Can you talk about, and I'd love to hear all of you talk about this, especially Chris, what do these conversations sound like between bikers and non-bikers when you're trying to advocate for more bicycling trails and, you know, these bike pathways? What does that relationship look like?
Well, People Power, throughout the history of this project, has been intent on showing that this was a good idea. I mean, this is a major project. This is a major use of funds. And so we've tried to demonstrate that this is going to have immense public benefit. This corridor is one of the most direct routes through Santa Cruz. The plan is for it to eventually connect up with trails down in Monterey, so you could have a corridor spanning the length of the Monterey Bay. And so, you know, 5 years ago, folks went in and actually built their own temporary trail. We had crews of volunteers, donated gravel, and made a little trail alongside the rail corridor, so that, you know, in the meantime, before an actual trail could be constructed, people could still use this route through town as a way to get around.
And can you just talk, before we let you go, how has biking really changed the city, not only Santa Cruz, but the area? What changes have you seen in the last couple of years?
Well, I would say higher and higher rates of bike commuters all the time. We have such great recreational cycling in Santa Cruz, great mountain biking and great road biking. And I think I've seen more different types of people out using the roads. And I think the more we can improve our facilities and make our roads comfortable for all types of users, the more we'll see that. The more we'll see people going to work and kids and moms and all different types of folks on the roads.
Chris?
Well, in terms of this agitational side of the question, I have a different approach than most people. And, you know, the Bike Coalition does the grind it out block by block, house by house convincing job, or tries to. And all of its foibles here in San Francisco, as we know, you know, it's very easy for any one cranky citizen to block a project. So it's really a difficult project to go out and convince everybody around to support something. Credit to those who have spent the time in those trenches. I'm not one of them. My advocacy takes the form of the big picture. Life can be much better than it is. The life that we've been foisted upon us by modern capitalism and the United States is just a pale shadow of how grand life could be. And those of us that have chosen to cycle have just taken it upon ourselves to get on with living this other way of life that we think is superior to the one we've been stuck with. And happily, that's been an inspiration to other people to join us. And now we have huge numbers that have come out to join us and are in that space that we inhabit together. We have bigger conversations. We do get to deeper philosophical and political discussions about how do we structure life differently? How would it be to really restructure an urban experience based on natural systems, based on, you know, free space for all the species, not just humans, to actually talk about cycling as a priority as opposed to an afterthought? These are questions that we are just super overdue. When you take the larger questions that are being shunted aside in the presidential election around climate change, et cetera, like, why don't we even talk about any of this stuff every day? Why do we go to work and do basically stupid things at work and then try to fix it on Sunday afternoon with a checkbook? It's absurd. It's not possible. You have to actually produce a good life. And we don't even have the conversation, let alone do anything towards it.
Peter?
Chris, you're not going to have to go have a beer at some point and have that conversation. But right now, back to the topic of agitation. Community outreach is incredibly important, and so as a public agency at MTA, it's really important for us to work with the community where these changes are going to occur or where we'd like to see them occur, and incorporate their needs. So I've done a lot of community outreach myself, and so for places like the JFK Bike Boulevard, Felon Oak, Masonic, there's a plan for Masonic to be streetscaped with new bikeways and transit stops.
Fell would be good because a lot of people ride on the sidewalk because the cars just fly by you, and you're stuck between this gas station line and these flying cars.
Exactly. So we've just gotten approved the Felon Oak connection between what we call the Wiggle. A lot of folks in San Francisco are familiar with the Wiggle and the Panhandle. That just got approved at our board, and there was a lot of community outreach for that, and you know, there's loss of parking, there's impacts to the folks that live there, so working with them, hearing their concerns, and coming up with a plan that they can be invested in is a huge path for us to have success in our projects.
And Amelia, going back to you in Santa Cruz, I understand there's going to be a party for this new 32 miles of biking and walking trail. Has a date for that been set yet, so we can let listeners know?
That is correct. That is going to be Saturday, November 18th, and there will be stops along the rail line between Watsonville and Santa Cruz, but a final party at Kelly's Plaza.
Okay, great.
And look at the RTC website for more details.
Well, that sounds great, especially biking along the Monterey Bay. That sounds great. So thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. That's Amelia Conlon. She is director of People Power in Santa Cruz. The Regional Transportation Commission just bought 32 miles of corridor from Union Pacific Railroad. It'll be converted into a trail for biking and walking. And we've got just about 7 or so minutes left. We still have full lines, so why don't we take a few, and then we'll get comments from our guests. Let's go to Hannah in San Francisco. Oh, I'm sorry, we lost Hannah. Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey.
Hi there. Well, I had a cousin who was killed here in Berkeley commuting to work. So
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, that is terrible. So I'm into dedicated streets, and my concept is that during rush hours, they can have streets that were closed from 6 to 10 a.m. and from 3 to 7 p.m., and then it's open up again. So that might be some sort of solution during before we have a more secure environment, but I think that's it. So streets dedicated during rush hours to bicycles, and that way they don't have to breathe the pollution. And when you put steel up against flesh, steel always wins, so it's safe for bikes.
All right, thank you, Harvey. Let's hear from Esther in San Francisco. Hi, Esther.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Esther. Hi.
Hey, I was imagining rail lines. You know, the truck drivers are understandably nervous, and you know, but they're a lot bigger than me, and I have to bicycle all day long, not just during commute hours. But I live on Valencia Street, so I know what he's talking about. But I'm imagining kind of retro a little bit here. We're a port city. We used to have rails all over the place. We still have rails down Market Street from the ferry building, and you know, wouldn't it be nice if we got some of that stuff delivered to hubs, and then bicyclists, you know, could transport it to the shops. Anyway, that's my little plug for
all right. Thank
improving the bicycle delivery people issues.
Thank you.
Valencia Street was not an improvement for bicyclists, in my opinion.
Thank you, Esther. We'll get a comment in just a minute. Let's hear from Philip in Berkeley. Hi, Philip.
Hi. Thanks. Yeah, I have a few suggestions. I'm kind of in a privileged position because I've been a truck driver, a delivery truck driver, and I'm a bicyclist. I bicycle mostly around Berkeley. That's all I do. And I have a few suggestions. One is that you narrow the sidewalk a little bit and use that space to put a lane in through the middle of the street, a protected lane for bicyclists, or you have a side lane that is between the sidewalk and where the cars will park, so that the bicyclists are next to the sidewalk and not out in the street. And I'd love to see more things like Ohlone Trail, which goes underneath BART, and there's no contact between bicyclists and traffic. And I'd also like to see possibly alternating the alternating closing of streets to traffic, except for the people who live there, those streets turned into bicycle streets for a day or a couple of days, and then you could alternate with another street or a couple of other streets, so it wouldn't inconvenience the people who live on those streets too much. And
All right, well, thank you for calling. I'm sorry to cut you off. We have so many emails. I want to read a few, and then you can all give us your thoughts. Michael says, two comments from my car perspective, reinforced when I'm on a bike. Most drivers treat bikes as either pedestrians or invisible. Invisible is bad news for bikes. Until city planners catch up to modern reality, bikers and cars do not belong on the same roadway. Great suggestion for crisscrossing city with dedicated bike ped paths. No amount of do-gooder suggestions changes that. My own kids have great bikes, now collecting dust in Berkeley until we take them out to a bike path, but allow them to bike around town or even the neighborhood. Forget it. Another email. Manhattan has bike lanes, curbside of parking. This would solve problems of double parking on Valencia. Have cars park in the bike lane and move the bike lane between the parked cars and the sidewalk. Love the show. Robert writes in, what do your guests feel about mandatory helmet laws? He says he noticed that bicyclists stop running they run red lights, illegal turns. We've heard this on many of our shows. Another email says, commuter biking is not spiritual, as Chris said earlier. It's tense. You have to watch out for traffic, potholes, and suddenly open car doors, and then deal with the weather when it's inclement. Let's make biking safer, but let's stop thinking that either drivers or bikers are superior and should own the road. By the way, Copenhagen is not all American or European cities where 30% of people biking may not be practical. And we have so many emails that we don't have time to get to. Just lots of suggestions about how to make it safer for everyone. So clearly, people really care about this issue.
It's a hot topic. Chris. It's absolutely a hot topic. And I'm going to add one more piece to the hot topic,
yes,
as opposed to responding to all those good ideas out there. We have this huge artery known as the Bay Bridge. And the Bay Bridge is currently being rebuilt on the eastern side of it. And it's being added to it a multi-use path, which has stupidly been put on the south side instead of the north side of the bridge. And the road deck's been lowered so that your nose on a bicycle will be precisely at tailpipe level, with the prevailing winds from the north blowing all the exhaust of the bridge directly into your face. Thank you, Caltrans. You love bicycles. We know how much you love bicycles. So we want to take it out of Caltrans's hands to allow them to control the completion of the bike path across the bridge. It's an outrage what they're talking about. They want to spend $800 million to $1 billion in about a 10-year program to hang new decks, cantilever decks, off both sides of the west span. This is the most colossal waste of money ever proposed. And it's being proposed deliberately to torpedo the idea of completing the bike path across the bridge. It's the main commute artery for bicyclists.
Where can we find more info?
It's basically not out there.
Okay.
So you can go look at Caltrans's ridiculous plans. But what we're proposing, me and some friends of mine, is to the Bay Bridge was restriped and reconfigured. I know, I'm trying to make it really fast. So the Bay Bridge was reconfigured in 1962. It used to be six lanes on the top deck, three lanes going each direction. We want to go back to six lanes on the top deck, give the sixth lane on the north side of the bridge to bicyclists and pedestrians, and put a little cement barrier there. And it could be done in one morning for $5,000.
All right, we'll let our news department know about that. Peter, final thoughts, 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think it's great to hear from the callers, and thanks for having the program and for inviting us to talk about this important topic. What I heard from a lot of the callers in the emails is a separated track is a great thing to do. We're doing that. And one thing I can guarantee is driving and energy will be more expensive in the future, and cycling might not be.
Well, that's good news. And unfortunately, we're out of time. We'll have to continue this conversation. Peter Brown is manager of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Authority's Climate Action Strategy. Chris Carlson is author of Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20. Find more information about his work at yourcallradio.org. And Fritz Bredell is head of communications at the Danish Cyclists Federation. Thank you all for joining us. And thank you for your many phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a conversation about media coverage of the issues raised during the second presidential debate, including energy policies and Libya. What's your assessment of the media coverage of the debates, and what issues have yet to be discussed? We'll be joined by Harper's Scott Horton, Mother Jones' Kate Shepard, and The Guardian's Jonathan Steele. Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.